Many people turn to cable to watch the Olympic events that were not covered on network TV, but with basic cable bills at a national average of $50 a month, some viewers are questioning whether it's worth it, especially when they can watch some TV shows for free at online sites like Hulu. And since last year's transition from analog to digital broadcasting, there's another free alternative, over-the-air TV. Catherine Welch of member station WHQR explains.
Trapped inside on a cold gray morning, Elizabeth and Philip Humphreys' three children stand perfectly still in front of the TV, all eyes glued on Elmo.
Why don't you talk to a glass of water?
Yeah, Elmo can talk to water.
I'll tell you anything you want to know.
Okay, how does it feel to be water?
Wet.
Thanks to digital over-the-air signals, the Humphrey kids can watch Elmo, Arthur, and other favorites on one of three digital channels broadcast by North Carolina's PBS station. The Humphreys also get the additional digital channels offered by their commercial network affiliates, giving them about 12 channels to choose from depending on where they point their antenna. Philip Humphrey climbs up into the attic, pushing past boxes of Christmas junk to where he mounted his new antenna.
Basically, it looks like a 2.5 by 2.5 square piece of welded wire fabric.
That's attached to the rafters and connected to the Humphreys' brand new HD television set downstairs. For the one-time cost of the set and the $75 antenna, the Humphreys have found an alternative to monthly cable bills. During the national transition to digital television last summer, the cable and satellite industries pushed hard to get viewers to subscribe, implying they might lose channels if they didn't. But many viewers didn't bite. Richard Schneider owns Antennas Direct in St. Louis.
What happened on the way to the graveyard is people started realizing they're extremely surprised at the picture quality that you can get off over the air. In many cases, the picture quality, the resolution is in fact significantly higher than you can get off a satellite or cable.
Digital television also boosted the number of over-the-air choices.
I think the broadcast-only environment is much richer than it was 2 years ago.
Pat McDonough is Senior Vice President for Analysis at Nielsen Media Research. Some critics say local affiliates are squandering the extra channels they got as they began to adapt to HDTV. But McDonough says how they're repeating shows is, in some cases, kind of creative.
We are seeing some of them time-shifting their programming so that I air my news at 6 o'clock and I can put it on again at 8 o'clock on my second digital channel while I'm airing my network prime programs.
McDonough says without cable or satellite, the average national viewer can pick up around 30 channels. In Los Angeles, they can get a whopping 70 channels. McDonough says the number of homes getting only over-the-air television didn't change much between 2008 and 2009, about 11 million households. And McDonough says it's not just viewers who can't afford cable.
5% of the broadcast-only homes have income of over $100,000. So clearly they have the means to afford cable or satellite, but they've elected not to purchase it.
The Humphreys, for example, they use their computers and television to catch their favorite shows. Elizabeth Humphrey admits that while they might miss some of the hot new cable shows, they're getting most of what they want.
There are times that you may miss out on some cultural conversations about a particular show, but we've found that if it's something that continues to pique our interest, that now you can watch it on the internet, you can rent it through Netflix, you can find other ways to get into the conversation.
You'd think that might worry cable providers.
We don't really view it as a threat.
That's Maureen Huff, Senior Director of Public Relations for Time Warner Cable. She says subscription numbers for cable television, internet, and phone services have stayed strong in the face of more over-the-air channels and the crummy economy.
Traditionally, cable tends to be sort of recession-resistant. People spend more time at home with their families in a recession. They're spending less money going out. And so cable companies such as ours tend to do okay.
Huff acknowledges that families who've made the choice to go without cable, like the Humphreys, are out there. But young Veronica and Mac have seen what they're missing at their friend's house.
Disney Channel and SpongeBob.
I wish I had SpongeBob.
Even Dad Philip has some cable craving.
Well, okay, the Daily Show would be nice to see.
But that, too, is available online. For NPR News, I'm Catherine Welch in Wilmington, North Carolina.
Our shows are often confused. You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News.
Let's ask about the knock-on effect of a court ruling in Italy this week. Three executives for Google were convicted of violating criminal privacy laws. They're not going to jail. In fact, they didn't even show up for the trial. But the digital world is asking about the effects of this ruling. Google may have to begin policing its content in Italy and maybe other countries as well. NPR's Silvia Poggioli joins us on the line from Rome. Hi, Silvia.
Hi, Steve.
What was the case all about?
Well, in 2006, a group of high school students filmed and uploaded a clip to Google's video site showing them bullying a schoolmate with Down syndrome. The video shot up to the top of the most entertaining videos and was online for 2 months. An advocacy group complained to police, which notified Google, and the company took down the video within 2 hours. Prosecutors charged Google executives with liability and said they should have taken down the offensive content much sooner.
Well, how is Google responding to the ruling?
Google will appeal, and it described the decision as terrible and astonishing. It said it attacks the very principles of freedom on which the Internet is built. Spokesman Bill Etchison said the ruling raises serious questions about the viability of all user-generated content websites.
This isn't just about Google either. This is about the web. It's every social network. Even a community bulletin board would be impacted if the rule is that you have to preview all material that goes up on the web. We think this is really a very important principle that needs to be defended.
But prosecutors say that what was at stake was not freedom of expression, but the responsibility of companies. Prosecutor Alfredo Robledo, reflecting European concern about privacy issues, hailed the ruling as a confirmation that the right to do business cannot prevail over fundamental human rights.
Okay, so we have this court ruling that could conceivably affect not just Google, but companies like Twitter, Facebook, anybody who puts up content without editing it first. What are the broader implications here?
Well, it surely looks, as you said, that they're going to have to police their own content, at least in Italy. User-generated websites may now be treated just like any other media company, TV or print, that provide content and therefore could be subject to the same regulations. But Google says preemptive screening of all content is not feasible, technically or financially, since worldwide, 20 hours of video are uploaded to YouTube every minute. Spokesman Etchison says the ruling is like punishing the messenger.
If this judgment stands, it will be a little bit like prosecuting the postman for delivering a letter that you don't like the content of. Are we going to prosecute the postman? Are we going to prosecute the telephone operator who carries a call where unpleasant things are said? No, obviously not.
The U.S. ambassador to Italy, David Thorne, endorsed this view, saying in a statement, "The fundamental principle of Internet freedom is vital for democracies which value freedom of expression and is protected by those who value liberty."
Sylvia, in a couple of seconds, is this just going to be Italy or is it going to spill over into other countries?
Well, we don't know that. Google right now is under an investigation from the European Union for antitrust complaints from other rival companies. Here in Italy, keep in mind that Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi owns the biggest commercial TV conglomerate and indirectly controls state-run TV. His Mediaset company is currently suing Google for nearly $800 million in damages for copyright infringements, users uploading clips from Mediaset TV shows.
Okay. Sylvia, thanks very much.
Thank you, Steve.
That's NPR's Silvia Poggioli.
Some internet companies are in shock after yesterday's ruling by an Italian court. Google executives were held responsible for a video on a Google site showing a boy being bullied. Web providers called the court's decision an assault on freedom. But NPR's Martin Costi reports that even before the Italian case, freedom on the internet has meant different things depending on where you live.
Google has framed this ruling as potentially disastrous. Spokesman Bill Etchison says expecting websites to vet everything that gets uploaded would be a threat to creativity on the internet.
It would mean the web as we know it wouldn't exist.
The thing is, the web as we know it doesn't really exist now, at least not in any one universal form. Things were more universal back in the 1990s, when websites especially were designed to be worldwide.
It's supposed to be uniform. One link consistently is supposed to point to a particular destination.
Jonathan Zittrin is co-director of the Berkman Center for Internet and Society. He points out that website addresses are called URLs, Uniform Resource Locators, but that's turning into a misnomer.
More and more what we see are that depending where you are, one jurisdiction versus another, Canada versus the U.S., the U.S. versus Thailand, that uniform resource locator isn't so uniform anymore.
Your computer's IP address, the numeric code that shows where you are, directly affects what you get to look at. Brazilians can't watch Hulu. Americans can't watch the BBC. Usually this is done for commercial reasons. The website may have rights to show the movies only in certain countries. But sometimes this regionalization also happens because of government pressure.
We've seen an increasing ability to have a local internet that could conform to local law.
China is the obvious example, but companies like Google have also restricted access to their sites in other countries. For instance, in Thailand, where YouTube agreed to block locals from seeing certain videos that the government found insulting to the king. And then there's Europe, which has more restrictive privacy laws than the U.S. The Italian case, for example, was based on the fact that the kid being bullied in that video hadn't consented to having the video posted.
There are likely thousands of privacy laws that can affect any one piece of data.
Trevor Hughes is head of the International Association of Privacy Professionals. Those are the people who work at companies like Google trying to keep their websites compliant with all the different privacy laws around the globe. But sometimes, he says, it's just not possible for a single website to satisfy every country.
While the internet is indeed a global platform, we certainly see organizations that cannot find a lowest common denominator with regards to compliance, or perhaps it's a highest common denominator, and as a result need to segment their offerings significantly.
This segmentation of the internet comes as a disappointment to some of the American idealists who'd hoped that the internet would become a global free speech zone that would trump local authorities. But those idealists sometimes also forget that freedom can mean very different things in different places. Jonathan Zittrin quotes an aphorism that's familiar to many internet law experts.
In cyberspace, the First Amendment is a local ordinance and doesn't protect you anywhere else.
As the laws and customs of other countries weigh more heavily on the policies of companies like Google, Americans who are fond of their own concepts of freedom may someday be glad that the internet isn't quite as universal as it used to be. Martin Costi, NPR News, Seattle.
This is All Things Considered. For our next item, I'm joined now by some guests who will now introduce themselves.
Hello, Robert. I'm Catherine. No last name. Sorry.
Well, pleased to meet you just the same, Catherine. You have a friend with you, I see.
Hi, Mr. Siegel.
Welcome to the program. And our next guest?
Hello, Robert. Folks know me as Debbie. Friends call me George. You can call me Mr. President.
Well, those people exist only in a software program. Actually, President Bush exists in real life, but his voice only exists in a program. Matthew Aylett is also real, and he joins us from Edinburgh, Scotland right now. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
And I should say that you are the technical officer of Seraproc, a company in Scotland. We've been hearing synthetic computer voices for years, but these take it to a new level. What are you doing?
Well, what has happened over the years is that the industry has developed and the technology has developed quite extensively. So before synthetic voices used to sound quite robotic.
I am Perfect Paul, the standard male voice.
Now they can sound extremely natural.
I'm in a bad mood, so don't come anywhere near me.
How do you go about doing this? How do you create a voice?
To a certain extent, the methodology is fairly straightforward. You take a lot of audio from a speaker. You then cut that up into tiny little pieces. Each piece is a little sound. So, for example, cat would be made up of three sounds, k, a, and t. In order to then produce a new sentence, you then take those sounds, you rearrange them, and you stick them back together again.
But you would need an awful lot of sound of one voice to do that.
Not as much sound as you might think, because although there are hundreds and thousands of words, within English there are only about 45 different sounds.
Now, we heard about you and your company when we learned the story of the film critic Roger Ebert, who after surgery lost his voice, lost the ability to speak. And your company is providing him with a synthetic voice of himself.
That's correct. So Roger has lost his voice, but he has, of course, an awful lot of audio that he's recorded in the past. So we've been able to mine this audio data and to produce a prototype of his voice for him.
He enters text, and the software finds those phonemes of Roger Ebert from things he actually said in recordings that you've assembled, and out comes a plausible Roger Ebert.
That's right.
How much harder is it to recreate the voice of someone, given a record of their speech that's been recorded, as opposed to just creating a Sue from the north of England or whatever?
This is Sue from up north, round Birmingham.
It's quite a lot more difficult. To record her, we got her into the studio, we gave her a script. Everything is recorded in the same environment with the same microphone. The material for Roger was a lot more difficult to deal with because, of course, it's recorded in different times with different microphones, different environments.
Now, you have brought some examples for us of other things that you've done.
Yes, so one of the things that we're interested in is putting emotion to voices.
What a lovely day.
We record the voice and then we can tweak it to give a little bit of a sense of emotion. Not as much as you'd be able to get out of a normal person speaking. But a little bit.
You never listen to anything I say.
The first one I think you played. Could you just play that again?
What a lovely day.
There's something I was trying to make President Bush earlier say gray.
Our director today is Melissa Gray.
Something about those vowels doesn't seem quite right, especially at the end of a phrase. There should be more oomph there behind it, and we don't seem to speak that way when we just give you lots of phonemes.
That's very observant. One of the biggest problems duplicating voices is getting the intonation right as well.
The application we've heard about for Roger Ebert is remarkable. Is there much of that, or are we still at the level of creating a fun thing to do on your computer as opposed to some new service that can really enhance people's lives?
No, I think this is the beginning of something very important. It's not just a cool piece of software. It really represents what we are as people. There's no question that we can reproduce people's voices if we have sufficient audio. And for them, that's really quite important.
Matthew Aylett, Chief Technical Officer for Seraproc in Edinburgh, Scotland. Thanks so much for talking with us.
No problem.
This is NPR.
Just a few years ago, burglars might lurk in the bushes or a parked car and wait to see a family leave their house or turn out the lights. But in this day and age, all you have to do is send a tweet. At Gene and Giorgetti's on Franklin, what's better, chicken Vesuvio or lasagna? A new site, pleaserobme.com, created by three men in the Netherlands, reposts such tweets by Twitter users who disclose when they're away from home. The site's founders say their goal is to raise awareness about risky information on the Internet. Ginger McCall, a staff counsel for the Electronic Privacy Information Center. They study emerging privacy issues. She joins us from her office in Washington, D.C. Ms. McCall, thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
Have you seen pleaserobme.com? How does it work?
When you arrive at the site, the front page lists people's tweets as to where they are. And it's funny because it'll actually refresh and it'll say, you know, five new opportunities have been posted, as in five new opportunities to rob someone have been posted.
And this is someone, for example, who says, I've gone to Garrett's Popcorn Shop on Clark.
Yeah, and it has the username and then the update. And sites like this create a kind of twofold opportunity for people who want to do bad things. First, it lets them know where you're not, which is your home. And second, it lets them know where you are. You know, if you're out at a bar late at night, you know, and you check in there, or you're out at a restaurant after dark and you check in there. I mean,
well, people do that to invite people in their following to meet them there.
It's true. And I think that maybe what they don't realize is that, you know, it's not just your friends that read that. Anyone can read that. Mm-hmm. It's out there.
Forgive me for not knowing, but who owns the information that people post on social networking sites?
I mean, I would assume that the social networking sites own it then once you post it. I know that Facebook has frequently claimed that it owns your information once it's posted.
It is public.
It is public.
So people can't, I guess, complain that their privacy rights are being...
I think that there still room for complaint, especially in regards to things like Facebook, because, you know, the company doesn't necessarily put it out there that this information that you're posting is going to be publicly available to everyone. When you're on your email, the people that you're interacting with, that's supposed to be private. You know, only you know who you interact with on email, you and that person. When you're on Facebook and you post information up, you're supposed to be able to filter that information, make it friends only, not make it publicly available. But the problem that we're seeing with these services is that they tend to change their practices. And then, you know, users are left essentially with their pants down.
I'm just imagining a tweet, pants down. Thoughts? Yeah. Ginger McCall, Staff Counsel for the Electronic Privacy Information Center, thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
This is NPR News.
The U.S. government has a plan to expand broadband access. More people would have more access to music and movies more quickly over the Internet. The government will present details of that plan later this month. Mario Armstrong, who monitors technology developments for Morning Edition, tells us what the government is up to.
Well, Steve, the government wants to be able to make broadband accessible, high-speed Internet access accessible for every American. I mean, the goal really is to try to get as many people to adopt and utilize high-speed Internet as much as possible. That's the end game here.
Interesting that they've laid out some priorities that have to do with public buildings and public places. They want every classroom and every school in America to be connected to broadband, every hospital, clinic, and first responder to be connected to broadband and have the ability to send medical information very quickly, very complicated digital images and so forth. Job seekers should have access to this through public libraries, all of which is very interesting, although, of course, most Internet use is in private spaces, I suppose.
Well, most Internet use is in private space, and that's part of the problem. It needs to be more in the public space. And when you talk about it seems interesting, I really think it's actually vital to have all of these types of different opportunities, to be able to connect kids from their home back to the schools. That simple thing doesn't happen today, and it could happen if we had a national broadband policy.
What's it take?
Well, it's going to take a lot of work. I mean, you know, you look at our ranking right now, we're 15th when it looks at broadband adoption specifically. I mean, we're, you know, behind places like Seoul, Korea and Scandinavia. And a lot of folks will say to me, well, Mario, that's because it's geography. You know, most residents live in a high rise or high density units.
Like
and it's
Japan
to...
or someplace like that, sure.
Correct.
Sure.
But the bottom line is most of their citizens in countries that are doing better than us in broadband adoption is because their governments made some formal policy decisions that created really a national priority. So when you look at South Korea, their government clearly articulated a vision for a national technology initiative. And I honestly believe that by having this national initiative from the government, it created more broadband competition, which in turn helped prices fall and helped speeds rise.
Mario, can I mention one thing? Because the federal stimulus bill that passed about a year ago now included more than $7 billion for one piece of this. It was an effort to extend broadband access, especially in rural areas. And we just had a report on this program recently that telecom companies were resisting that money. Are corporations going to allow expanded broadband access?
Yeah, you know, this is going to be, Steve, a major challenge because, see, a lot of these telecommunications companies are saying, we don't want the stimulus funds because, and here's where I think the big challenge is, it's requiring these companies to have open access to the lines. And what that means is these telecommunications companies would have to share their lines with competitors.
And they don't want to do that.
They haven't shown that they wanted to do that in the past, so why would they do that going forward? But this opens up a tremendous opportunity for smaller companies as well as companies like Google, who have recently announced their big Google Fiber for Communities with the goal of helping to experiment with new ways to make Internet access better and faster for people. And so now you have cities and community groups all across the country. People in my hometown in Baltimore have started BeMoreFiber.com, all with the idea of wanting this opportunity of having faster Internet connectivity in their backyard to help their businesses, to help their schools, to help healthcare, to help fix social challenges that are happening in their respective cities. So here you have a company that's not a telecommunications company, Google, coming in saying, we're going to look at providing 10 times faster than what the FCC is proposing because we feel that there needs to be some type of shakeup in this industry to get us there.
So Google thinks that private industry can step in here.
Absolutely. And, you know, other people would say, well, private industry is already stepping up. They're putting significant investment into broadband. That's why you see all these commercials and you see all these things about 3G and bigger networks. But the bottom line is, if you look around and you look at the data, you see that there are not enough choices in enough areas throughout the U.S.
Are people in rural communities, public schools, other areas that don't have broadband clamoring for it now?
Unbelievably so. I mean, I've Twitter with these folks, Facebook with them. Some of them are telling me how they are still on dial-up. And I, you know what? It's hard for me to really understand what that must feel like. I mean, I clearly remember being on dial-up, but golly, that's been so long now. It's hard for me to really understand that in today's age, 2010, that there are people still trying to get access to information just like everyone else, but they're doing it at turtle speeds through dial-up.
Mario Armstrong, always a pleasure to talk with you.
Likewise, Steve. Thanks for having me.